Disclosures. So we know that looking, where someone is looking, tells us a lot about their cognitive state. We know that it tells us, in some ways, what that person cares about, and to some degree, who that person is. This process of social attention and social looking has been flagged as a possibly very powerful indicator of efficacy in clinical trials. And one way that we can get to social attention, at least overt social attention, is to use this technology of eye tracking. Now, eye tracking in of itself is very, very simple. Essentially, we're looking at where the pupil is pointed, and where the pupil points tells us where someone is looking. Obviously, there's some more technical details than that, but essentially, that's it. Eye tracking has been used to really good effect in terms of finding between-group differences for children with autism and individuals with autism, typically developing and development-delayed controls. A recent meta-analysis showed that this was a fairly robust finding across a large number of studies. But the fact of the matter is that when we're thinking about eye tracking, it's not the eye tracking technology where the power is coming from. The power is coming from the paradigms that are being used, and there are an essentially limitless number of paradigms that we can select from. And so how do we control this space? I think that's a really important thing for us to ask ourselves. And so I have to apologize in advance, because where Shefali made everything so exciting for us, I'm just going to make it take it down a few notches. Because I think, you know, this is something that we have to grapple with, right? The complexity. How do we make sense out of this? How do we turn this technology in conjunction with paradigms into markers that actually can do something for us? So the first thing I think we need to do is we really have to ask, why are we using these markers, right? What is it that we're aiming to do? And once we've decided what that is, then we can start asking questions about the details that we need to fill in. And from that, we also have to keep in mind that there's going to be limitations to whatever we're trying to do, right? And so we have to understand that there's going to be a context that these markers that we create are going to be able to be valid. Now, some paradigms of note, and this is not exhaustive, just some paradigms that have really reached a high level of prominence in recent years, include paradigms like the one by Karen Pierce, where there's essentially kids dancing on one side and geometric shapes, a screensaver, on another side. And Karen has shown that the pattern of looking at social information versus looking at the geometric shape tells us something about autism severity. It tells us something about stratifying the groups in terms of their specific characteristics. Work by Warren Jones and Ami Klin, that I hope that we'll be hearing a lot more about tomorrow, has shown that developmentally there's these changes that occur across development that really may be informative of not just who ends up having autism, but also the mechanisms that might underlie the pathogenesis of the autistic disorder. But social communication is not really the only domain, and we have to remember that autism is a heterogeneous disorder with a lot of facets. And other studies, like the paradigms used by Noah Sasson and Bodfish and colleagues, look at scanning patterns towards these complex arrays of scene. And these patterns of looking at these scenes correlate and are associated with circumscribed interests and repetitive behaviors. Similarly, if we just ask the question, a recent study that we did looked at just scanning patterns towards central fixations, which are these little kind of bright lights that appear on the center of the screen in between trials, and we found that in the toddlers with autism were amongst the highest lookers at that type of stimuli, as compared to other social stimuli where individuals with autism tend to be looking less. So That's kind of just a small survey of some of the different applications that we can have with eye tracking in terms of understanding autism or looking for specific characteristics associated with autism. But it gets even more complicated than this, right? Because you can actually take one paradigm and use that for a number of different purposes. So this is a paradigm that's called the spontaneous social orienting paradigm. It was created at Yale by Kasia Varska and Suzanne McCary and a number of us at the Child Study Center. And the paradigm colloquially is called the sandwich lady, because she makes a sandwich. And so many of you have seen this and are very tired of it.
You're
and I apologize.
Did you like the movie?
She, you know, makes a sandwich. She looks directly at the scene in different sections.
Did you see the tigers?
And looks directly at the camera, emulating direct eye contact and speech, and speaks in this child-directed speech. So 20-month-old toddlers look less at the faces when presented with these scenes if they have a diagnosis of autism as compared to developmentally delayed or typically developing controls. And they look less at the mouth. They look more at hands. They look at other extraneous features of the scene. Importantly, they also look less at the screen overall. And this is associated with the lost data that's coming out of the eye tracking, which, you know, really in some ways tells us something about the attentional systems in individuals with autism. And there's a question, you know, what is important in this scene in terms of social looking? And is there a continuum that goes all the way across, you know, to the point where you're not looking at the screen at all, not participating in this experiment, tells us something about that child, right? Because this is essentially the only thing that's happening in the room at that time. And so it's important to realize that even lost data can be a powerful measure. Now, this paradigm was also applied to 6-month infants at familial risk for autism. And even at 6 months of age, those infants who would go on to develop autism showed diminished looking at the scene overall, decreased looking at faces and people. And, you know, asking questions in a different way, we can look at the emergence of or atypical scanning patterns as the result of different familial risk factors and biological risk factors such as sex. And so a recent study that we did looked at infants at high risk and low risk for autism and stratified by males versus females, finding that it was actually girls who were at high risk for developing ASD who looked at the scene the most. And this is developmentally from 6 months to 12 months of age, and look the most at the faces. And this is in comparison to low risk girls, but also high risk boys. Thinking about that, that really tells us something about the characteristics associated, basically pulling out different characteristics associated with biology, associated with risk factors in autism. For the purpose of stratifying these kind of complex genetic groups. Another study that we did a few years ago looked at scanning patterns at 2 years of age in toddlers with ASD, development delays, and typical development, stratified the groups on the basis of their scanning patterns towards the face and the scene and the eyes versus the mouth, and essentially found three groups, a group of non-lookers who didn't look at the scene much at all, a group that looked a lot at the mouth, and a group that looked a lot more at the eyes, both of those last two groups looking a lot at the scene, finding that the group that didn't look at the scene overall showed diminished lower levels of verbal ability, higher levels of autism symptoms as compared to the other two groups. So this kind of shows that even within a specific experiment, we have a lot of potential, really, of using these different types of techniques, just focusing on different questions and applying a specific technique to a lot of different ends, right? And so while it is possible to adapt these different experiments to different purposes, we might also question whether or not this is the ideal way to reach those endpoints. And I think that's a question that we really are going to need to think about in terms of the optimality of the types of systems that we're trying to develop. At the same time, it's providing us a lot of information right now about the structure and the issues that are related to autism biomarkers work. Like, things that we want to know about are being revealed through the application of these paradigms that we're starting to understand really well. So, you know, just like there is a spectrum of applications of even a single paradigm, there's also, you know, when we really think about how we analyze eye tracking data, there's a spectrum of methodologies as well. And so a very kind of fundamental unit of eye tracking is the fixation. Fixations are moments in time where we're stably looking at different spatial areas on a scene that we're presented with. And they're kind of separated by saccades, which are rapid movements between fixations. Well, if we run an algorithm to extract saccades versus fixations, there's a parameter. There's different parameters that you could set to get different patterns of fixation. And there's generally no one agreed way of setting those parameters, which means that you can get a variety of different patterns of fixations, all of which look pretty reasonable. But the problem is that when we come to think of those fixations as solitary units that have meaning in of themselves, we realize that, well, you know, actually, results can change very much on just the parameters that we select, so much so that, if we select one set of parameters, we're saying that individuals with autism have lower fixation times in general, and when we change the parameter to the other side, they have greater fixation times. I mean, this is a complexity. But looking at the entire structure, and I think that that's something that we need to do, we're still in many ways looking at the landscape of possibilities. And just like we're looking at the landscape of possibilities in terms of paradigms, we're looking at the landscape, we can look at the landscape of possibilities in terms of our data processing to realize that when we use something like a fixation algorithm, we're really trying to characterize a distribution. And understanding that parameter space means that we can understand the structure and figure out ways of translating these pieces of information together so that we can represent the distributional properties of scanning patterns as compared to a single slice at a specific parameter selection. And some of the work by Quan Wang, who's a research scientist at Yale, has shown that there are some properties of scanning patterns which are very kind of universal and related to search flight patterns in natural systems, natural biological systems. So to take another look at analyses. It's important to realize we also have a lot of these analytical possibilities in front of us. Just like we were looking at the fixations, we can actually think of other ways of looking at scene information or scanning patterns in terms of instead of looking at region of interest analysis, which is the standard way which we analyze eye tracking data. Essentially, we say we carve up the scene into a bunch of different pieces, and we say how long are you looking at one place versus another. We can use more general techniques, such as a cohesion technique that was developed by Quan and myself, and with the help of a lot of the researchers at
the
Child Studies Center.
Are you having fun?
Okay, she's kind of
creepy.
So, I'm sorry. So this cohesion technique relies on this idea that scanning patterns of typical children is very behaves in a very regular fashion at certain moments in time, and this regularity can be used to ask the question: well, how do children with autism deviate from this? And applying this technique to a large sample of toddlers with ASD developmental delays and typical development, we found that the scanning patterns are most atypical during these dyadic bit scenes where the actress is making direct eye contact and talking in child-directed speech. So was that a 3-minute or 1 minute?
That's three.
Oh, we're perfect then. We have 32 slides for a 15-minute talk, and Jamie scolded me a little bit, and Jerry did also earlier, so I was feeling very guilty. Now I've used up all my leeway, I'm sorry. All right, so... So coming back to this question of eye tracking as a biomarker, right? Like all the different choices and selections we have, what do we really want to do with these measures? And I think that one of the things that we care the most about is using eye tracking in clinical trials to track the effects of treatment, to track the effects of intervention, to figure out what types of intervention will work the best for which individuals. And I think that's universal for our reasons for wanting to study, and develop new biomarkers. And, we don't have a lot of data on this right now, but I would say that, as far as eye tracking and treatment goes, we're on the cusp. We're starting to see a regular large set of really good studies come out of high quality that are finding use in using eye tracking as a marker of change. And at the same time, it's important to realize that we're getting some negative results too, and that's a good thing, because we don't expect that every single paradigm should be equally effective at doing getting what we need to. And a lot of the work that has come about recently from the study of things like single administrations of oxytocin, which work by Andari in 2010 showed that there were scanning pattern changes when individuals with autism were given intranasal oxytocin. More recent work in conjunction with Roche Pharmaceuticals has shown that the infusion of a novel V1A antagonist over a period of 2 hours was associated with increases in looking at scenes where actresses were kind of interacting over a shared activity in adults with ASD. And other results from the same study showed that an infusion of this novel compound was associated with increased orienting towards biological motion as compared to these control conditions. Now, I think what's going to happen over the course of the next few years, if it's not already happening now, is that we're going to start seeing much more concerted multidisciplinary activity towards trying to discover what biomarkers are working and what are not working. And recent work by Thomas Frazier has addressed this question of creating autism risk indices. And essentially what he did is he took a number of different paradigms and kind of assembled clips from all of these things to create a single marker of autism risk, which he used to great effect to show good stratification between groups of individuals with autism and individuals with other developmental issues, and also showed that this measure had good relationships with autism symptomology. And this is one of the first examples of, you know, really thinking about the outcome as the target. And I think that we're going to see a lot more of that, and I think that we should. Because we really need to ask ourselves, what do we want from a biomarker? Now, the number one thing I think that we all want is that, first of all, it has to be the index into the pathology. On the practical side of things, it needs to be easy to use. It needs to be usable, right? And there's sometimes a trade-off between that usability and how accurate and robust it is, and we're just going to have to figure out what that trade-off is. And we have to really deal with the issue of the multiple uses of eye tracking. So do we want to use this for treatment monitoring? Do we want this for prognosis? Do we want this for early diagnosis? And there's no reason why we would expect that the best paradigm for one of these should be the best paradigm for the others. And I think that as time goes on, we have to figure out what is going to be best for what. So future directions, we really need to refine our ask. I think we need to understand what it is that we are trying to look for, because once we know what we want, that'll give us the targets, which will tell us which methods we need to use. And this, as an example of this, if we are interested in early diagnosis, we're really talking about identifying best predictors. If we're interested in change in social communication as the result of an intervention with an emphasis on social communication, we may be talking about the best surrogate markers for social communication. If we're emphasizing the intervention, we might be talking about looking at the best proximal markers of that intervention. So thinking about what that intervention is and building our measures so that it matches those interventions very closely. And some work that we're doing with Pam Ventola at Yale is trying to address this for pivotal response training under some Simons funding. Finally, we need to understand the limitations and capabilities of our biomarkers as we move on. We have to deal with these issues of replication and methodological rigor, some work by the Autism Biomarkers Consortium for Clinical Trials, and other large-scale efforts by the EU Ames are starting to address these questions, and it's vital that we are able to address these so that we can have faith in our approaches for biomarker development. And finally, you know, I'll say that we've always wanted this one-size-fits-all biomarker, but that might not be realistic. The idea that there's something that fits everything that we want probably doesn't make sense, but what may make sense is that everything out there that we might care about may be fit by something, and it's for us to figure out what that something is. So I want to thank a large number of people, especially Kasia Vraska, who brought me into both eye tracking and autism research, all the wonderful collaborators and researchers who we've worked with to make all of this work happen. Thank you all for paying attention. I'm sorry, I'm over.